The Islamic Republic is a threat to stability all around the world, and governments have to just be clear-eyed. Trying to appease the Islamic Republic regime is a complete failure.
Welcome to Premier Christian Radio's Babel Undone podcast featuring Archbishop Joseph D'Souza. Bishop D'Souza is a renowned Christian intellectual and human rights activist from India who leads the Good Shepherd Movement and the All India Christian Council. And I'm Johnny Moore, an American evangelical who serves as the president of the Congress of Christian Leaders. I come from America. The Archbishop comes from India. So naturally, we meet in London. Bishop, what's today's subject?
A very interesting and exciting subject titled, An Iranian Woman Tackles Jewish Hatred.
You know, foreign policy in the Middle East is complicated, to say the least. Academics and activists, religious leaders have spent decades trying to usher in peace throughout the entire region. And yet there is this ever-present threat of terrorism and violent escalation. And so much of that conflict can be sourced in the extremism emanating from the Islamic Republic of Iran. In fact, some have even said that Iran's radical regime is the source of virtually all of the conflict in the world that causes us the most concern. It is also the foremost exporter of anti-Semitism, which has infiltrated Europe and North America and many, many corners of the world. We've seen this in the nauseating rise of anti-Semitism across college campuses, all over social media. And so today we have the opportunity to discuss the response to this problem with an Iranian-born woman who is Jewish, who has dedicated her life to fighting Jew hatred at home and abroad.
We have the privilege now to speak with Eli Kohanim, former U.S. Deputy Envoy to Combat Anti-Semitism for the U.S. Department of State. Eli has long criticized the Iranian government for its aggressive anti-Semitism that it exports to the Middle East, and she's one of the most vocal supporters of Jewish rights in the States and around the world. Her research has informed her support for countries designating Hezbollah as a terrorist organization and freezing its assets. Having completed graduate studies in international relations at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, Eli continues to use her platform to champion the rights and interests of the Jewish people.
Eli, I always like to begin these conversations with the same question. And at the risk of being boring for our listeners, I just find it to be a really, really fascinating question to get to know people. And here it is. Very, very simple question. Who is Eli Kohanim?
Well, Johnny and Bishop, first of all, it's so wonderful to join you. And that question about who is Eli Kohanim is a mystery to me as well, but I will try my best.
Welcome to the club.
Thank you. Yes, right? A life of introspection. I would say, I guess, I'm a very patriotic and grateful American. I think my life story has kind of put me at the intersection of three different cultures, two different countries. I'm someone who was born in Iran in the Middle East. We fled the anti-Semitism of the Khomeini regime that took over the country in 1979. And we came to the United States and we were given refugee status. And so, I'm a Jewish American. I was, born to a proud Jewish family that traces our ancestry back to ancient Persia for thousands of years. So I would say that I am somebody who intersects and tries to straddle the Middle East, the West, Jewish identity, but old friends from the Muslim world, good friends in the Christian world, and really trying to and bridge all these cultures and feeling so much appreciation for all of it.
And Eli, you were born in Iran. You came to the United States of America. You love America. You're a patriotic American, as you say, and as I've always known you to be. I wonder, like, Explain to us why you fight so hard for the people of Iran and Iranian women and all of this, right? You have a new country. You know, this has been your country for your entire life. You've served this country in the Department of State as a historic figure, the first person like you to hold the position that you held as an envoy for the State Department, specifically focusing on anti-Semitism. Like, why do you keep fighting for the future of that country that frankly caused you so much harm?
Johnny, you know, I can't imagine leaving behind the Iranian people in a nutshell. You know, I was a child when we escaped. We had to kind of run for our lives. One of the first acts that the regime committed was the execution of the president of the Jewish community, Mr. Habib Elvanayan. And so at that point, my father, who had conducted some business in the 70s under the Shah with an Israeli company, understood this as potentially a threat on his life. And so we escaped, and the vast majority of Jews from Iran wound up escaping over the years. So a community of 100,000 Jews is now approximately 10,000 Jews left. But Johnny, you know, in answer to your question, I can't imagine leaving Iranians behind. I know that I'm so blessed and fortunate that I was able to come to the United States, that I was given refugee status, and that I was able to build a life in America, and so fortunate to have been given every opportunity in the world. I really feel like my life story has been an American dream story. But I can't imagine just leaving everyone behind. You know, it's wonderful to have all of the rights and privileges we have living in the West, but I can't imagine leaving the Iranian people behind, who I know deserve the same basic human rights, the same civil rights that I enjoy living in the United States. And frankly, you know, it was a life that they had before this revolution and this radical Islamist regime, which usurped power, in my opinion, in 1979.
And, you know, your feelings for the Iranian people resonate with us. But in your work as an Iranian Jew, as you fight against the anti-Semitism that Iran is one of the prime propagators of around the world, and especially in the Middle East region, you are also connected with the struggles of the Iranian women, aren't you? Because they seem to be rising in revolt every few years, and they get squashed, and they get up, and they squash. So the rights of Iranian women must be very heavy upon your heart.
Exactly right, Bishop. And you're so correct in pointing out the bravery, the courage, and the heroism of the women in Iran, who, as you just mentioned, Bishop, you know, we've seen the women in Iran take to the streets. And unfortunately, so many of them have taken bullets to the head. They've suffered awful oppression, persecution, torture in Iran's notorious Evin prison. All for their demands to simply, you know, have equal treatment in their country, to have the freedom to choose whether they want to wear hijab or not. Again, to enjoy basic human rights and civil rights that we enjoy in the West. And so I have tried everything I can in my power to support the women's movement, the freedom movement in Iran, and really try to let the West know, and I think this is really important, that the way that the country, that Iran is functioning right now, is not something that is indigenous to the culture of Iran. You know, it's not the way it's always been, and therefore it should just be that way. Again, you know, in the 60s and 70s, under the Shah, the women of Iran, if you saw pictures of my mom, as an example, in that time when I was growing up, she looked like she could be in Paris or London or New York or anywhere in the West. You know, she was wearing the most fashionable mini skirts and the hair styles that were trendy at the time. And, you know, importantly, women in Iran were gaining all kinds of freedoms and equalities. They were advancing in education and in their careers. And so, you know, what happened with 79 and the Islamic Revolution is that it's a tremendous setback for women. But, you know, not only for women, I would say for religious minorities, for ethnic minorities, and really for all Iranians. And so the women have definitely been, though, at the forefront of this fight for their freedom.
So you've told us what Iran was like before the Ayatollah, which, by the way, we had a fascinating conversation not long ago with a Christian leader in Nigeria, with everything that's happening there, you know, countless Christians slaughtered. And he's been in Nigeria for his entire life. He's an older gentleman now. And he actually traces the extremism that they're experiencing in Nigeria also to the 1979 revolution in Iran. He believes that this was the spark that sparked all of this, you know, all around the world. You've told us what it was like before, a modern country, you know, a cosmopolitan life, this incredible, ancient, thousands of year old, you know, Persian culture, like all this melting pot of the world, of trade, of everything else. What is it like today to live in the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Johnny, what we know is all the public reporting of what life is like in the Islamic Republic. And what I was referring to just now is that life is horrible for everyone in the Islamic Republic, other than the regime officials, their cronies, because for one fact, Iran is an energy-rich country, right? It's not only an oil-exporting country, but also a natural gas-exporting country. And so it should be one of the wealthiest countries in the world with all the resources that it has. And yet there's tremendous poverty because what the regime has done, you know, for the last 45-46 years now that they've been in power is that they have stolen the country's resources to line their own regime pockets and also to take the country's resources and spend it on their terror activity, their malign activity throughout the Middle East, North Africa, and Latin America, and Europe these days, and also on the nuclear program. So basically what the regime has done is make life miserable financially for the average Iranian, and also with their brutal oppression, which again affects every group in the country. I mean, if you think about Mahsa Amini, who was the spark for the women's freedom movement, right? If your audience remembers, she was a religious Muslim Kurdish, you know, girl from the Kurdish Iranian region who had come to Tehran, apparently to the big city from a small town region to visit her uncle, and her hijab was, you know, maybe not 100% perfect, and the so-called morality police arrests her in Tehran, and they wind up murdering her. She was a pious Muslim girl, you know. Wow. So there's nobody in that country who is spared the evil of the regime.
How do you think with the October 7th event in Israel and the rise of anti-Semitism, and of course the Israeli confrontation with Hezbollah and with Hamas, how do you think this is all going to play out vis-a-vis Iran?
Well, Bishop, I would say first that what we saw on October 7th and since then, and of course, you know, in the years leading up to October 7th with Iran's, you know, ring of fire strategy of surrounding Israel with its terror proxies, what we're seeing play out is Iran being true to what they tell us every day, which is that they want to eliminate, the regime says they want to eliminate Israel, and that they want to push the United States out of the region. And so they have dedicated resources, as we just discussed, and have done everything in their power to try to do what they tell us they want to do, which is to eliminate Israel, wipe Israel off the face of the earth. Because they are intolerant of the very notion of Jewish sovereignty in the Middle East. In terms of what comes next, Bishop, you know, I am so grateful to God for the victory of President Donald Trump as our incoming president of the United States. And I have to tell you, his inauguration day cannot come any sooner. As we all know, the world is on fire in so many
Amen.
Places. Right. So I think now, Bishop, with this new American leadership, we're going to see much more American support for Israel and our allies in the Middle East, North Africa region in general. And we're going to see a much tougher stance against the Islamic Republic. I mean, the one thing that I feel so confident in saying is that President Trump is just very clear-eyed, both from the moral perspective and also understanding who America's friends are and who our adversaries are. And so we're going to see a foreign policy that reflects that. And I would expect that the Islamic Republic is going to be cornered just the same they were cornered by the first Trump administration in terms of being left by the end of Trump's 4 years on the verge of bankruptcy, with the elimination of their number one terrorist, the head of the IRGC, you know, so much weakened and really in the corner. So I expect that we're going to have the Iranian regime, you know, cornered again and weak. And so hopefully we will be containing their malign activity.
I have, and we have interviewed today, I interviewed Johnny as well on the American elections. We are relieved that, and I say this as an Indian, that Donald Trump won, because really what we were seeing is the dismemberment of Western Christian culture and civilization, and really a naivety with regards to extremist Islamism, and an unwillingness or a spineless strategy of not confronting evil. With Trump, that's not going to happen. I mean, the problem here in Europe still is there is a naivety of what the true agenda of extremist Islam is. When it comes to Israel, they don't want the Jewish state. When it comes to the rest of the world, they want to dominate it. And for good or for bad, we are all getting drawn into this confrontation. And it is, I mean, like you, I'm thankful to God that something will be done in terms of weakening what I call, you know, the darkness that Iran aims to spread all around, the darkness of violence, the darkness of hate, and the recruitment of innocent people into terrorism. I mean, the kind of things we have seen Hezbollah and Hamas do is unbelievable. And so,
yeah.
So, you know, one wishes, you know, things would not be where they are today, but without destroying them, what way would the world have forward?
Bishop, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that we are at a historical turning point. And maybe because all of us are in it, we can't even, you know, quite feel it or see it or understand. But you know, I'm convinced that we're at a historical turning point, and that President Trump's victory, you know, please God, is now having us moving in the right direction, where it felt so dark, as you just said, so dark for me in the last 4 years. And so hopefully we are getting to the light. And you know, and exactly what you said, Bishop, being a little steely-eyed about the threat of radical Islam to the whole world. And also, let's just be honest, also to Muslim populations. I mean,
yeah,
the biggest
right.
victims, right? The biggest victims of radical Islam are other Muslims. So this is a threat to everyone who is, you know, a moderate, a peaceful, law-abiding person.
Ellie, what do you think that the not only the new American administration should do, but what should the Europeans do? What should other countries do immediately in order to address all the issues that the Islamic Republic unfortunately has caused or thrown gasoline on around the world.
So one policy prescription I would share, and that goes back to what the bishop just said, and this one should be easy because it's about domestic policy for all of these countries. And it's not just about the Islamic Republic, but every country should be shutting down its borders and protecting its borders. You know, immigration policy has impact on so many different areas. Every country needs to get a hold of its borders. And if you have allowed in criminal elements, radical extremists, then deport them, because that is the only way you're going to create safety back for your citizens at home. So I think that is it might seem difficult, but I actually think it's one of the easiest steps that any government can take, because it's a domestic, it's, for every country, that's a domestic issue. Then you get to more of the foreign policy stances. And, recommendation I would have is for countries to designate Iran's IRGC as a foreign terrorist organization, and slapping sanctions on all of those IRGC affiliated individuals. I think people would be shocked to know how many Iranian regime children and grandchildren and tied individuals live in places like the US, Canada, and the West, and how many billions of dollars they have siphoned off and are hiding in the Western world. And so all of those assets and those individuals should be on the radar of law enforcement. But speaking more broadly regarding the Iranian regime, look, you know, I think it's time for world leaders and the international community to just be honest about the nature of this regime, which is that they are the leading state sponsor of terror in the world. They are the leading state sponsor of anti-Semitism in the world. They, you know, all roads in the Middle East of destabilization and malign activity lead back to Tehran. And it's not just a Middle East problem anymore, as we're seeing the Putin-Iran, the Russia-Iran alliance strengthen every day, and the back and forth between those two countries and supporting each other's military advances. And so now it's a European problem. And the Hezbollah presence and Iranian boots on the ground in Latin America has been a problem for many years, which in the U.S. there isn't a lot of conversation on. So you know, the Islamic Republic is a threat to stability all around the world. And governments have to just be clear-eyed that trying to appease the Islamic Republic regime is a complete failure. And so the Obama policies, the JCPOA policies of trying to reach some sort of a deal with the Iranians, the approach of appeasement simply does not work. And it's really time for the international community to take a stronger stance against the Islamic Republic.
So, Ellie, I believe that one day when this terrible era of the Ayatollahs is over, that a free Iran will have a lot of women in its government. There'll be a lot of religious minorities in the government. It'll be a new amazing country that we can all visit. And who knows? Maybe you'll be the first American ambassador to Tehran and into a free Iran. And we have to pray for those people every single day. And we also have to fight for them too, because as one of my mentors taught me, which he borrowed from a famed Christian leader from a century and a half before, we got to pray like everything depends upon God, but we got to work like it all depends upon us.
Wow, that is so beautiful. And Johnny, first, let me just say amen. Amen to your vision for a free Iran. I know we all are going to keep fighting for the Iranian people and really also fighting for our own national security interests and our own interest, whether in the UK, in the United States, India, really all around the world. But amen to your vision and amen to my becoming America's first ambassador.
Yeah,
I thought
amen.
You'd like that. Well, you're an amazing human being. You've made a big difference around the world. You continue to do it. And we thank you for spending some time with us today.
Johnny, it's an honor to know you and consider you my friend and Bishop my new friend. So thank you so much, both of you gentlemen, for having me on.
Bishop, I've known Ellie for many, many years. I knew of her work before I knew her, but I really got to know her when she was at the U.S. State Department, and she was the deputy envoy to combat anti-Semitism. So it's one thing to combat anti-Semitism, you know, if you're Jewish. It's another thing to combat anti-Semitism if you're Iranian and Jewish, because she came to the United States of America and fled a country that is the foremost sponsor of anti-Semitism all around the world. And, you know, I'm always amazed by these people. Like, if you saw Ellie, you don't see her on our podcast because it's audio only. We just have these conversations. But she's just like this small little elegant woman and a lioness. I mean, the Ayatollah himself is terrified of this lady who's decided to do everything necessary to stand up for the women of Iran. And she and people like her are an inspiration.
I mean, Iranian women, more than men, have been revolting against the system there. I mean, you had the case of this woman in protest who, not undressed, but wore a bikini in broad daylight, and we hear that she was taken away and probably now killed because she exposed herself, and now London and some other places, people who are revolting are doing the same because they want to express their solidarity with her. Is there enough that the global community is doing, the human rights community, the feminists are doing for the women of Iran?
There's no greater indictment on Western civilization and the human rights community than what we have not done for the people of Iran. I mean, we've now had three or four rounds of national protest where Iranians, going back to 2008, 2009, early 2009, all the way to just in the last year, where they poured on the streets by the thousands, most of the time led by women. In fact, two protests ago, a couple of years ago, the chant was "Women, Life, Freedom," and it was in response to Mahsa Amini. That was her hijab fell. She didn't even take it off; it fell, and the religious police beat her to death. And thousands of people went on the streets. And did they get the support from the United Kingdom or from the United States of America or Europe? They got a fraction of the support they deserve. So, you know, what we need to do is, you know, there's a lot of talk in the United States about maximum pressure on Iran, sanction Iran, force Iran to change its behavior when it comes to terrorism. That's not enough. We need maximum pressure on Iran, but we need maximum support for the Iranian people, young people and women that go on the streets demanding basic human rights. And every women's organization ought to be standing up for them, every human rights organization, every Western democratic government. And instead, I'm just so sorry to say, they very, very often go out on the streets knowing that no one's going to be with them and they're sacrificing their life. And I just pray to God that one day Iran is changed, that we visit Iran and a new Iran. And I guarantee that Iran will be led by the women of Iran.
I believe so. And I'm glad that Babel and then podcast, this will be the second time we're talking to an Iranian woman, and we'll keep it on the front burner.
That's the least we can do.
Thank you for joining us today for Babel Undone. If this conversation had you thinking, then why don't you share it with someone else? For more episodes of Babel Undone or other amazing content that helps Christians live out their faith, you should head over to premier.plus. That's Premier, P-R-E-M-I-E-R, for the Americans listening in, God bless.